I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurta, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is very exciting. This is the second anniversary of Origins, which is a conversation about food and sustainability and how we do what we do. And I'm just thrilled because I was at the first Origins to be at the anniversary. Just want to remind everyone, this is being recorded. It will rerun on Heritage Radio, which is out of Brooklyn, and they're very focused on food and sustainability, and they will be rerunning it. And I want to thank the fabulous staff of Artifact for putting this all together, and to the amazing Dana Slater. I don't know when she finds the time, but she has organized this series, and I know some of you have been at previous events. It's been wonderful. There was one on cheese, one on women farmers. It's been a great education for me, and I've enjoyed being part of it. I'm going to introduce someone who probably doesn't need any introduction. This is Spike. How do you pronounce your last name? I should have asked him. Jurta?
I should have actually changed my name to Spike. How do you pronounce your last name?
Is it Jurta?
Yes.
Am I saying right?
Yeah, you got it.
Spike Jurta, because
yes.
You read the name, but you don't often hear the name. Okay, so Spike's pursuit of cooking has been linked inextricably to his pursuit of local ingredients through the viability of local agriculture for his entire working life. He has founded and grown a family of restaurants that returns real and meaningful value to those responsible for the bounty of those restaurants' offerings by choosing to buy and serve only the products of growers, watermen, and other producers in the Chesapeake region. With a long tenure on the line at the wood-fired oven and in the pastry kitchen, his cooking is thoughtful, straightforward, and truly ingredient-driven. However, his real vision is in connecting this cooking to its outcomes, the effects of eating this way on our farmers, the Bay, and its surrounding landscape, the people of Baltimore City, and the ongoing culinary traditions of the region. Spike is the chef and co-owner of Woodbury Kitchen and its sister restaurants in Baltimore City, a family which will soon extend to Washington, D.C., with the opening of A Rake's Progress at the Lion Hotel, which will be a very wonderful addition to Washington. So I'm just going to jump in and start with a question for Spike. You obviously had a successful restaurant before you began Woodbury, or several. You had Spike and Charlie's, you had Vespa, you had other restaurants where you did some farm-to-table kind of sustainability, but you really went much, much further with the food shed and with Woodbury. So I'm just wondering, why do you do what you do? Because you could clearly be successful if you did less.
Yeah.
Not that I'm suggesting.
I wish I would have figured that out. No, I appreciate you asking that. It's you know, it's true that, you know, over the course of running other restaurants with my brother back in the 90s and into the 2000s, I kind of started to connect with a lot of the ideas that are now manifest at Woodbury. And what happened at Woodbury is that we opened with a commitment to source locally. I had a sense of what that meant, but I didn't know really how to do it. And what's happened in 9 years since we opened Woodbury is that we've learned how to do it. And We're kind of trying to grow the footprint. Woodbury exists within four walls under one roof, and everything that happens, you know, everything that up until recently happened in that space. That was all the butchery, that was all of the baking with local grains, that was all of the canning and preserving. And gradually over the last couple of years, we started to kind of expand that and find other places to do that work. And And that's, to me, is the coolest thing that we're doing right now. We've done it with baking. I'm sorry, we've done it with butchery at Parts and Labor. We have an amazing state-approved canning facility, space that we share out in Elkridge, where we're doing all the snake oil and all the tomatoes and jams. And we're working. We have plans to build a bakery in southwest Baltimore that will fully take everything we do with grain, not only the baking with locally grown and milled flour, but also we'll do some milling there. We'll also make tortillas with local corn, and we'll make pasta and noodles with the same local grains. So really excited about our ability to kind of expand, what all started at Woodbury. But the other thing that's happened over time at Woodbury was I became more aware, thanks to people like you, about what was going on with agriculture around the Chesapeake Bay, the impacts of that kind of agriculture on the bay, the kind of food that we were growing, the kind of food that we're eating. And I became more motivated over time to do more, which I think is one of the big pieces that's missing a lot of times in our conception of farm to table is why the hell would you do this? Which is, I think, what you're asking, right?
Right, right.
And my answer is I have a lot of answers to why the hell I'm doing it. And, I got less happy over time with what I found out about our food system and became more determined to try to do something and more importantly, to separate myself and Woodbury and everybody that works with us completely from it. I didn't want anything to do with the industrial large-scale food system, the global food system that I think is causing a lot of problems and is going to cause even more problems.
Sure.
And I think that's the no lemons thing. That's why we're trying to use we're reducing and hopefully eliminating the use of granulated or refined sugar. This is all motivated not from my ability to make things even harder for us, which it kind of does, but to really confront a lot of these issues that I think are either buried or we're not talking about, which is something I hope we get to tonight. And that's what Woodbury is now.
Well, since you brought up the lemons, this has been something I've been curious about since I first interviewed you maybe 10 years ago. How do you do anything without lemons? A bar program. I mean, is that what has been the hardest thing for you to get around? Or is that just my lazy cooking where I put lemons in just about everything?
I think it's undeniable that lemons and limes and citrus is delicious. What I found is that when you make a commitment like we've made, and if we could just say, we're going to source everything locally, that means that you're going to get things locally, but it also means that you have to start. I think you have to re-examine what you mean by everything. If I said, I'm going to ride everywhere on my bike, that might be an interesting thing to do. And one of the things you're going to have to do is to kind of redefine where you're going to go, because you're probably not going to go to the mall.
Might not go to the mall anyway.
So what I'm trying to say is that our willingness to kind of redefine or define, I should say, what everything is for us and base it on what we can get is one of the things that separated us from others.
And maybe it is also a little lazy. I mean, with the lemons, you cut a lemon and you put it in water and it's a little bit wasteful and it's sort of a shorthand to diners. Oh, hey, this is a little bit more upscale than your average restaurant, but instead of putting a lemon in, which I usually take out, you could actually wow them with, here's what I can do with a locally sourced pork shoulder, here's what I can do with a locally, with the snake oil and the other ingredients. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it's a way of sort of saying, we are going to show you that we can do things, but we don't need to just cut a lemon and put it in the water. We're going to do more.
And I think, I would say, we find other sources of acidity and mm-hmm. the underlying reason for eliminating lemons and doing things the way we do is so that we can return value to growers.
Right.
And so the sources of acidity that we use at Woodbury and Artifact and everywhere else are locally derived. So that's a big deal for us is verjus, which is the sour juice of unripe grapes, which we get from a number of local wineries now. And, I think we're responsible for the verjus explosion. No, there is no verjus explosion.
But there is a fish pepper explosion.
There is a fish pepper explosion.
And you are responsible for that.
I think I helped that along, and we helped that along, and there were a number of other people that made it possible. But, I would say, the thing I would say, people have, looked at the Woodbury phenomenon of no lemons and kind of given a shit for it, and that's fine, I get it. But why didn't anybody ask that question? Why isn't... you know, somebody wrote about it in the newspaper and said it was stupid, or that, you know, Spike should get over himself or whatever, but didn't really dig any deeper than that.
Right, right. And I mean, it is, I think it used to be kind of a shorthand for fine dining, that when there was a lemon in your water, you knew, you know, you were in a fancy place. But I don't know that we really eat that way anymore, do we? I mean, you can go to a hole in the wall and have a great meal, and you can go to a restaurant that you can wear jeans and a t-shirt and you know, spend $120. So I don't know that we need that anymore.
Let me try to take over for a second, and you're asking me questions that I never get asked by journalists and so I just want to take a second, kind of introduce you more completely, and then I might kind of turn the tables and ask you a couple things, if that's okay. Are you ready for that?
I'm ready for that. Yeah.
So by now, you know, this is Rona Cabell. She's an incredible reporter here. You live here in Towson, right?
Yeah.
But your beat, I guess you could say, is the Chesapeake Bay.
Yes.
And you mostly write for the Bay Journal. You've written for The Sun. You've done work with YPR, et cetera, in the past. Also, Grist, Slate, Modern Farmer, Columbia Journalism Review, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post. Incredibly accomplished person. But where Rona first kind of wowed me was here at this table, as she mentioned at the very first Origins. And what you did there was you were a part of a panel on oysters, and you provided what I thought was, what still is for me, the best kind of recent account of kind of recent oyster history. And I had read a lot about oysters, and the history of oysters in the Chesapeake is fascinating to me and well documented, you know, through the 1800s and 1900s and the oyster wars and all that. It's fascinating to read about, but I had kind of lost the thread and until I heard Rona kind of just very concisely but completely describe what had been happening kind of under the recent, you know, from who was that governor we had?
The last one, O'Malley?
No, before that. Or
Hogan. Ehrlich.
Ehrlich, yeah. So you were kind of talking about that.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away. And that was one of the reasons it stuck with me to have you back and to talk about, you know, not only things that we care a lot about, you know, around the Bay, around agriculture, but also about what it's like to be telling that story, what it's like to be writing that story, helping, I think, create this narrative. And one of the things, you know, hearing Dana talk about just before we got together here about, you know, why this is important. And I share that completely about, you know, trying to advance this conversation about our food. In some sense, I've come to understand what Origins is about also is kind of documenting this moment in time of what we're dealing with, what we're thinking about as people that care about food. And I think we've done a really cool job of that over these 15 installments. And why I'm excited to talk to you is you're somebody that does it for a living. And to be honest, you may have now kind of gathered that I'm a little dissatisfied a lot of times with the way the story's been told.
Oh, yeah.
And not with you. No. But, and
It's a low moment for journalism, for sure.
Yeah, so why do you think that is?
I think, well, the national press, I feel like it's been a low moment for a long time on the television, talking about things that most of us don't think are important, and kind of a shout fest about keeping score and this kind of thing. That, but in terms of the Chesapeake Bay and the local issues, I think the problem is that there is no more longevity anymore on these beats. There used to be a core of us Bay reporters. We would see each other at things like the Oyster Survey or, you know, the Bay meetings, and there was someone from the Norfolk paper and the Newport newspaper, The Sun, The Post. There was maybe 8 or 9 reporters, and we were all friendly, and we competed, but we were friendly, and we kind of shared information, and now the core is gone.
When was that moment where you had, like, this cadre of...
When I was with The Sun, like 2004 to 2008 or so, and my competitor at The Sun was a guy named David Farenthold, who is doing exceptional work at the Washington Post detailing the Trump Foundation. He's a terrific reporter, and he was a great Bay writer, too. So, I mean, and a couple of them sadly passed away, and one guy, one of the best Bay reporters, Lawrence Lanahan, became an organic farmer outside of Richmond. So, you know, but the other thing about a lot of the Bay writers is we really liked covering it, and we wanted to stay on it. And so when I had the opportunity to leave the Sun and come to the Bay Journal and keep my beat, I jumped at it because I thought, I've been doing it now for 12 years, covering this the Bay, and for 4 years before that, I covered Anne Arundel County. And I feel like there's so much more to know. I mean, I appreciate you saying that, you know, I'm an expert in some things, but I feel like the more that I learn, the more that I need to know. And most of the reporters don't get that opportunity to learn more. They have to write the story for the next day, and they don't dig any deeper. And, you know, I think the reporter at The Sun is covering the Bay and probably five other beats. So he writes a story, and then the next day he's doing something completely different. And a lot of what I cover is very complicated. It's agriculture, it's science, it's a lot of different things. And if I'm doing something else and I get back into something, I need to re-educate myself for a minute and say, oh, okay, how does that work again? Because it's not simple stuff. And I just think you need to put somebody on it, or a few people, and dedicate them. And we're not good anymore as a country, I don't think, at complicated. We like black, white, red, blue. And, you know, a lot of the people I cover on the Bay, you would think, like, it's a very sort of bluish kind of beat, all the environmentalists, and, you know, it isn't really. I mean, there's that, but there's also the farmer piece. And, I mean, I talk to people all the time who, you know, politically completely different from me, and, you know, they have totally different ideas about life, but, you know, they don't want pollution to go into their stream. And so they're working on it. And to me, like, these issues have never been, like, really politicized, and they shouldn't be. It's about how you live. I mean, who wants to eat a chicken filled with a bunch of crap that's unhealthy for you? Nobody. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or, you know, who you are. Like, you want healthy food, you want clean water, and we've let it get to a point now where things have become so politicized that, you know, even making a statement like that probably makes me sound like I'm some, you know, hippie environmentalist. I am wearing a hemp dress, by the way. It just came in the mail today, and I'm so excited.
Because you're working on a hemp. You're a hemp.
Because I'm working on a report on hemp. But no, I mean, it's you know, so I think that is unfortunate, because I do think we are interested as a people. You know, most of us are interested in the topics about the way we live, and we aren't hearing much about that. You know, like,
have we just lost our capacity? Like you said, we don't do complicated well, but stormwater runoff is something that's huge for the Bay, right?
Right. Oh,
and
yes.
And the whole thing gets reduced, you know, again, maybe politicized to its extent, and it's called a rain tax, the attempt to remediate and pay for it is called the rain tax. And
you are like speaking to my heart, because the rain tax was like a topic of endless frustration for me, because it's not a tax, and it's not about rain. It was always about pollution, and for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, I think to get it passed the way it got passed. I mean, it was for the 10 largest jurisdictions, Baltimore City and the 9 counties. So it was passed that they would have to create a fee, like a entity, to deal with their stormwater. And the legislature gave them carte blanche to decide how. Somehow this became a political topic, and then it got overturned. But the rain is still raining. The runoff is still going into the streams. And meanwhile, if you want to call it a tax, call it a fee, call it whatever you want to call it, but you have to do something about it. Because, you know, what's going on is we have rain and we have sewage, and they're meeting in lots of places, and then they're going into our rivers. And, I mean, you travel to other places, and so do I, and you see, like, that it doesn't have to be that this way. Like, Baltimore's got a really, really bad pollution problem. There are lots of other cities, like Cincinnati, that have dealt with their problem. So you go place, and for a long time, I feel like Baltimore, it was like, oh, well, this is just how it always was. You know, the harbor's polluted, and that's just that. And I feel like there started to be a momentum maybe like 6 or 7 years ago to change that, which is great. And I think things are happening. But I also sort of see this sort of like it's too complicated to deal with, so let's not deal with it. And that's one reason why we have really made a lot of progress in Maryland with the sewage treatment, because that's just about money. Like, you put several million dollars into a sewage treatment plant, and you can fix it. You flick a switch, and it's, and boom, your runoff is reduced. But with the stormwater, you have to pay. I have to pay. And I think it was unfortunately poorly explained to people. And it drives me crazy. Like, my neighbor said something to me about, oh, O'Malley and that rain tax. I was like, you know, it's, I mean, it's just, and I had a show on YPR with Dan Rodericks for about 5 years, a monthly show. And we devoted, Dan is wonderful, and he devoted several shows to talking about the rain tax, which was kind of gutsy because, you know, there are other things to talk about on the radio besides, you know, stormwater runoff. and we took calls from people who would say, like, well, why should I have to pay? And it was like, you know, I don't know how to make it any more clear. I wrote lots of columns about it, and so, you know, it's a source of frustration that the rhetoric, you know, you get a hold of the rhetoric, and then you can't change people's minds. And in fact, what's kind of happened in some of the counties, like Harford County, they railed against this rain tax. They didn't want it. Well, they're using money and they're doing stuff about stormwater, but they're just not calling it the utility or whatever. And
so, problem solved.
Right. And there's actually like 1,600 entities in the United States that have stormwater utilities, including really progressive towns like Lynchburg, Virginia. You know, so like the fact that we can't do it here is kind of mind-boggling. I mean, so, you know, if they can do it in Lynchburg, home of Liberty University, like why can't we? I mean, they're not like a bunch of hippies there. I mean, they're conservative people, and so that's what I mean about, like, I think environmentalism gets kind of a rap as being like, oh, you know, you elite. Twice today I was called a coastal elite. I don't even know if you can be elite from Baltimore. Is that possible?
That like, might be an oxymoron.
But
coastal elite.
Okay. Coastal elite.
If they only saw us now.
Right, exactly.
Well, I want to go back to oysters for a second, because, yeah, again, you made a big impression on me on, you know, just the way you were able to describe the recent history of oysters. Maybe, I don't know if it's too much to ask for an update of where we are now. I mean, oysters are still central to what we do at Woodbury. They will be central to the meal we're going to share after this, after we're done talking here, or not, we won't be done talking, obviously. Well, we'll continue talking.
I can try to give like a really, really short.
I would love that. Yeah.
Like the 90-second version of the hour-long talk I gave. So basically, oysters in Maryland and Virginia, you know, throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, it was a wild fishery, and the oysters began to collapse around the time of the Civil War, because New England and New York had pretty much taken all of their oysters. They came here to take our oysters. It was a big problem. We tried to stop them with different laws. Didn't really work. And so around the turn of the century, around 1900, Virginia decided to privatize its oyster fishery and go to like a leased bottom system. And then you would pay a very small amount of money and you would get like a plot of land, and you would be able to put seed and shell down and tend to your oysters. They still had a wild fishery, but they had leases.
In 1900?
In 1900, yeah.
Wow.
They did a survey of all the bars. In Maryland, they're called the Yates Bars. Virginia has another name for them. But they did a boat, and they did a survey of all the bars in the bay. You still actually hear them talk about the Yates Bars, because they haven't really redone the survey for 100 years. But they surveyed all the bars. Virginia went to an oyster aquaculture system, which is what they have in place today. Maryland decided to pass a series of laws to make the oysters harder to catch. So they had a rule that you had to go under sail. You couldn't do it 7 days a week. They limited the hours. They limited the days. They limited the gear type. You know, you had the dredge was legal. They made the dredge illegal, and then they eventually brought the dredge back. But they had all these different methods in place to sort of restrict oystering. And then in the 60s, disease hit the oysters in both Maryland and Virginia, but Virginia worse. And they sort of struggled along. And then in the 80s, it got really bad with the diseases. And Virginia turned its lease beds over to clams. And they made a lot of money in clams. It was probably like a $20 million industry at one point in Virginia in clams. And so they, Maryland is sort of just watching as Virginia is, you know, weathering the storm a lot better than Maryland is. And but everyone who suggests that we should legalize aquaculture faces a pushback from the powerful watermen of the Chesapeake Bay. So around the early 2000s, Governor Ehrlich decided to sort of take a look. The way the Maryland legislature often does this, they form a committee and they explore. And as they're doing that, there's a discussion to put an Asian oyster in the Chesapeake Bay. And Glenn Denning was over my dead body, we're not doing this. But Ehrlich thought it was a pretty good idea. Virginia was more wary. They wanted to do an oyster and aquaculture like they do in Washington State, where they grow all sorts of different species. Maryland just wanted to put it in the Bay wild and reproduce, and many, many environmentalists and state agencies were really concerned. So Maryland eventually started kind of looking a little bit more at aquaculture. And then when they decided, after many millions of dollars on study, not to put the Asian oyster in the Bay, Virginia was already in a good place to have a really good industry because they had done all these experiments on the Asian oyster and the native oyster, and they had made what we call a triplet, a sterile native oyster, to compete with the sterile Asian oyster so that you wouldn't have a reproductive population of Asian oysters and maybe cause an invasive species introduction, which nobody wanted. So this is sort of an accidental. It was the control group, and it ended up performing better than the Asian oyster. And so now they had this sterile native oyster. And what they found was when the oyster is putting all of its energy into growth and none into reproduction, it grows faster. So a wild oyster in the Bay, I realize I'm taking longer than I meant to.
That's all right.
a wild oyster in the Bay grows an inch a year. So 3 years for a wild oyster to come to harvest. The triploids were starting to show that they could grow in 18 months. And disease hits at about year two. Now the guys in Virginia have gotten so good at this that they can get an oyster to grow in like 8 months. But that they were doing like different breeding and they figured out how to make it grow faster. And so they suddenly had all kinds of people getting into the oyster industry that hadn't been in it before. And these were really smart guys. They had, you know, some of them were watermen, some of them were entrepreneurs, some of them were like retired police officers. They're just people who thought, you know, hey, I can take this product and make it better. And Governor Martin O'Malley was kind of watching and thinking, well, why aren't we doing that? And so at the time, there were 6 oyster growers in Maryland.
Where are we now?
This would be like 08, 07, 08. There were 6 of them. And he went to go see them and talk to them about what they were doing. And they said, you know, you need to make it legal because it was really hard to get a license to grow oysters in Maryland. You could do it, but it took years, and the Army Corps of Engineers was a big stumbling block, whereas in Virginia it was really easy. Like, you just apply 3 months later, you have a lease. Maryland was really tough, and so they said to O'Malley, you have to pass a law to make it legal to grow oysters in every county in Maryland, and the other thing you have to do is streamline it so we apply to one place and one person says yes or no, because the early oyster farmers, they were applying to grow oysters, and they had to talk to the Coast Guard and the Maryland Department of Agriculture and the Highway Department and, like, 8 different agencies. And then, like, the National Marine Fisheries Service would say, no, wait, but there's sea turtles. And, I mean, it took forever. And so they streamlined the procedure, and in 2010, the first leases were issued, and it has increased about 1,200% since 2010. And there are about 400 leaseholders in Maryland. It's a $5 million industry. As of this week, these are the numbers I got from DNR. So it's come along a really long way. And I think we're just at the beginning. You would be better than me to answer the question of the demand for oysters. It seems to me that the demand for oysters is really growing now, and people really like to take pictures of their oysters and put them on Instagram. I don't know. I mean, I'm a journalist. I appreciate good food, but I'm not like a foodie, I guess, but it seems that oysters have captured people's attention and they cannot get enough of them. Would you agree?
I would say, in my experience as a chef, you know, we were committed to serving oysters from day one at Woodbury. Farmed oysters that were, you know, not wild oysters that were being kind of pulled out of the bay, but farmed oysters. It just made sense. I think still makes sense.
Yeah.
It's one of the more, I mean, people do like black and white. It's almost as black and white as you can be about a food. It's like oysters that are being grown in the Chesapeake Bay are, there's just not much of a downside.
Right.
And that's unusual. What I'm seeing, so we've always had oysters at Woodbury, and I love the fact that it's a nicer restaurant and you have oysters. You know, on some level, Woodbury's trying to do this fine dining experience without a lot of luxury ingredients. Right. You were mentioning earlier, we don't have the lobster, we don't have the Dover sole, we don't have the, we have truffles, but it's a very particular little truffle that happens to grow in Maryland. I just discovered it last year. But we don't have a lot of those kind of luxury ingredients, and so oysters, I think, is one of those things that it's like, that's special. That's a night out. I think that, you know, a well-shucked oyster is one of the greatest things you can have, especially when somebody else is doing the shucking. And so we're really happy to be able to provide that. But what I'm seeing in Baltimore are great new oyster bars opening up.
Yeah.
Dylan's is open, the local oyster. Thames Street has been around for a little while, but it's amazing. And
it's so good, yeah.
I'm so glad that the oysters are back. But the places and the culture and the enjoyment of oysters is also kind of back in Baltimore as well.
Well, I have a question about that for you because M.F.K. Fisher wrote that book, Consider the Oyster.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that strikes me about oysters is, you know, I did not grow up here. I actually grew up keeping kosher. So to me, like, the oyster is like a really fascinating creature. And but like my mother-in-law, she makes this oyster casserole. And like it seems to me that the way people used to eat oysters was kind of a way we don't eat anymore, like cream and sherry and, you know, all this kind of. So we went from kind of like a oyster as like a common food, almost like chicken, like you'd put it in a casserole, to oysters like, you know, $12 or $15 for six of them. And I guess I'm wondering, like, what do you think of this trend? Because, you know, it really highlights the oyster as opposed to, like, the other stuff,
yep.
You know? Like,
I think there are a couple of reasons for that. A, that they're more expensive. And I think we've come to understand with what we do at Woodbury that more expensive a lot of times is more appropriate. I mean, valuing your food a certain way and then being willing to pay for it. I used to kind of be back on my heels about people would say, well, isn't it more expensive when you buy this local stuff? And I'd be like, well, if you source it right or get it in season. And now I'm fully on board with, yes, it's more expensive. It's supposed to be more expensive.
and it's worth it.
It should. Yeah. And if the value is going back to the grower, that's a good thing. And it, you know, the way that a Heinz Tome or a Zach Lester or a One Straw Farm, Joan and Drewitt One Straw Farm, the way that they grow and the way they're scaled compared to other farms around the country, around the world, it absolutely is going to cost more to get this great food that we're eating. So I'm totally for that. I think with farmed oysters, it's a lot of work. It's very demanding.
Right.
And it's worth it. We pay, you know, typical oyster. I don't even know what a wild oyster costs these days. I know that the range for us is pretty tight around farmed oysters, and it's usually around 60 cents each.
Yeah, that's the going price. And then, like, 80 cents for, like, the local oyster does those big oysters that they sell to the casino. Like, an extra special large one would be, like, 80, I think.
And so, the other thing that I think is happening is that these oysters, these farm-grown oysters are taken care of. A lot of times they're tumbled, which helps deepen the cup and reduce kind of the bill size and make it a little easier to shuck. But in general, they're very delicate. And they're smaller, and I think they're better to appreciate on the half shell than buried into a casserole or a stuffing. Or we love to do that, but the Bay oyster of yore was particularly suited for that, and it wasn't particularly valued for its brine. It was valued because it was meaty and big, and to put it into a stuffing or into like creamy cheesy casseroles is a cool thing, but the Bay oyster of yore, the wild oyster, that tended to be bigger, tended to be a lot meatier. And if you see the way that old school stabber shucks an oyster, he puts it on the top shell and doesn't serve any of the brine at all. And I think that oyster was the one that you would was in those recipes?
Well, one of the frustrations, there was an oyster farmer that I had been writing about for a long time, and he called me one day, and he asked me if I would do him a favor and call the old Ebbett Grill in Washington and ask them why they had no Chesapeake Bay oyster on the menu. And I said, that can't be possible. Like, you know, they serve oysters from all over the world. He said, just call them. So I did. And the guy said, well, you know, we don't serve Chesapeake Bay oysters because the quality is not consistent. And we don't know, like, when we're going to get them. And I said, well, are you aware that there are farmed oysters now? This would be like maybe 2011, that you can get a farmed oyster in Virginia and you can get a few different kinds in Maryland. There's about 9 or 10 growers in Maryland. They didn't know.
Wow.
And so I'm wondering if I think there were two people in Virginia, the Croxton cousins, who really took the Chesapeake Bay oyster and got it on the map for quality. But I'm wondering, do you think, like, did you have that impression early on? Like, did you think, oh, the Chesapeake Bay oyster, that's not a consistent product? Or like, did you have that kind of in your mind that, like, you weren't sure what you were getting because it was a wild product?
No, it was one of the first things I was sure of is that we were going to serve oysters at Woodbury, and it was because of the Croxtons, Travis and Ryan, and what they had kind of got the brand back.
And
were among their oysters were among the first, if not the first, that I could get that kind of measured up to what I was looking for, which was a farmed oyster that was consistent and great. And, you know, they were able to tie the oysters that they were growing themselves in the Rappahannock River, but also others that they were helping bring to market as far away as like Chincoteague and Snow Hill and in Mobjack Bay. And they really connected it back to the bay or wherever they were being grown. And I love that. And it's only gotten better since then. The other guy who was Uncle Ernie, he was...
Oh, yeah, from Tangier.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was that guy, I think, when you were talking about the process of getting approved. He told me about what he went through to get approved. He's in Tangier Sound, so he's in Maryland. And what he had to go through to get approved in Maryland. And after I heard that story and after I got to know Uncle Ernie, who's now retired, I think he moved as far away from the bay as he could get. After I heard what he went through, there was no way I couldn't support him and serve his oysters. We were always so proud. They were beautiful. And he would go out there in the winter and break ice to get them up to us. It was just amazing. So that kind of, those kind of connections were made and kind of fostered over time, that's just cemented the farm Chesapeake oyster, you know, in my
So do people come here for oysters? Do you feel like they specifically seek it out?
Here, like to Baltimore?
To Woodbury.
I think, I'm not sure. Yes?
Yes.
It'd be great if they did, and I think it's a great experience it's challenging to do, and it's one of the toughest stations at Woodbury to work, and it's one of the first things you have to do if you're going to kind of get into the kitchen there is you work on cold side. And that's where the oysters are shucked. And you have to learn how to shuck oysters. It's kind of a starting place for us, maybe because nobody else wants to do it. It's important to be able to have that in a restaurant that's going to respect and kind of work off the traditions of a place like this. And having a nicely shucked oyster like we talked about is a key. I think people still come to Baltimore and to this region because of the reputation we have for great fish and shellfish, oysters.
Right.
Crab, rockfish, and other things.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I'm not sure if the reality really is borne out by the. I don't know what you think of the state of the bay beyond oysters right now.
Well, it's an interesting question because I think a lot of times you go to a restaurant and you order fish and you think it's local and it turns out that it isn't. You know, right? I mean, like even unless you specifically order rockfish or something that you know, or like in the season of yellow perch, if I come to Woodbury and I know that you have it on the menu, but I don't know. I mean, everyone's probably had the experience, right, where you go out for crabs and the crabs are from Louisiana or North Carolina, and like you would assume they would be local, but they're not. So I do think we continue to have a reputation, and you know, I think sometimes we do take it for granted that we have the seafood here, because if you talk to friends from the Midwest, they have to pay a fortune to get things like scallops and shrimp, and we don't have to pay that much for seafood here. So I mean, but I don't know. Like, unless you know that it's local, I think it's probably not. Right.
Probably, I mean. Yeah. And even yes, I mean, we have an easy way to handle it at Woodbury. We just serve tilapia. Everything's tilapia, but we just call it whatever we want.
Oh God! I remember when I was on the speaking of yellow perch, when I was out fishing with Tony Conrad, who did one of the origins, and I told him that my kids like to eat tilapia from Target. I think he was going to throw me off the boat. He was like, sure. "Don't." Tilapia is supposed to be like the absolute worst. Right.
In a number of ways.
Yeah.
A happier thought is that Tony's just let me know that he's going to be setting his fike nets for yellow perch. So if the weather kind of, this funny winter we're having kind of holds, we'll have yellow perch.
Can I ask you about yellow perch? Because yellow perch is one of those things where, like, I don't know what you do about yellow perch. Because on the one hand, there aren't that many. Yellow perch is, for those of you who don't know, an absolutely delicious fish. That has beautiful roe, and for a very long time, we pretty much sent all of our yellow perch to Ohio. I don't think they deserve it. But a couple years ago, somebody within the Department of Natural Resources, Steve Villanet, who was one of the first seafood marketing people, excellent guy, started encouraging chefs to serve yellow perch. So I'm wondering, what do you think of it? Because on the one hand, like, there's a short season, there aren't that many of them. But on the other hand, like, if we're going to fish them anyway and send them to Ohio, shouldn't we get to eat them?
Yeah.
Like,
I thought that was a great, I thought it was great that Steve, he was the one that kind of woke me up to the, you know, the fact that yellow perch are running in kind of late winter. And I was excited to have this product, something coming from the Bay that I wasn't really aware of. Yeah. And you're right. It's a great little fish, but the roe in the yellow perch is so sweet and so delicate.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And I think anybody that maybe misses local shad, because we haven't seen and shad roe as a local commercial fishery for years, that could be changing. But this yellow perch roe is just spectacular. We make it into kind of a caviar. We serve it in with eggs as kind of a classic old school French. Dish, and we make botarga. So we have like dried, salted perch roe that we can shave on top of pasta, and we're excited. We're going to unleash that on DC in a couple months and see what they think of Chesapeake Bay botarga.
The run starts in March, so I encourage everybody, if you've never tried this fish, it is really delicious, and even my picky children ate the roe, which
excellent
something.
So this might be a good time to kind of, we got an amazing crowd here tonight, a lot of familiar faces, and certainly people that care about their food system. Can we get, you have questions?
Yeah, any questions?
Thank you for explaining the rain tax.
I didn't expect to be doing that tonight, but.
I never knew what that was about, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
My question, I'm born and raised in New Jersey, and I came down to Maryland in 2008 where I discovered the oyster tax credit. I'm a CPA as well, so my wife and I have been paying a rancher for that tax credit. Can you explain more of kind of that?
Is this the $500 for the revolution?
So either you pay $500 in your taxes to the state of Maryland or you pay $500 to an oyster rancher. I've been paying it to an oyster rancher called Circle C Ranch.
Are they still in business?
Yeah, I just emailed them. Like,
you might want to check that.
but yeah, I don't know. And that's I've never eaten an oyster, but I just thought, hey, my money's going to Clean
so
the Bay.
So in 2008 or 2009, there's an oyster entrepreneur named John Farrington who developed this system called the Oyster Revolution. And it was like a lot of people grow oysters on their piers. This thing turned the oysters. Like, gravity made it turn. So, like, if you're a working person and you have an oyster cage on your pier, like, you're probably going to forget that it needs to be shaken and turned, and you're going to leave it there, and it's going to get fouled, and it's not going to do what it's supposed to do. So the revolution used the waves and kind of turned it like this so that the oysters kept doing what they were supposed to do. And he engineered it, so it was like a tax. It was like you could buy it for like what was a tax credit.
He is a rocket scientist, so some of it's like above my head, all the things that, that he does on his oyster farm. I don't know if like anybody can get the oyster tax credit. I thought that you had to like buy a Revolution and have property, but maybe they changed it so you can just like donate the $500 to someone who does. Circle C used to operate down in St. Mary's County where Patrick Hudson now has his oyster farm. I guess Rich Pels, who was one of the original oyster farmers who started it, must have moved his business somewhere else. I haven't talked to him in a while. He was one of the original six oyster farmers that
I remember Rich.
That was Circle C.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So this has been plaguing me for a while. I went to Parts and Labor with my friend Jackie.